Hey, music makers. Today's episode is sponsored by Caulfield Cables, an awesome boutique family-owned business out of California making high-quality, high-fidelity, and beautiful instrument cables. They can do all kinds of custom orders, whatever you need, and they're happy to announce the launch of their new HD series of cable. If you saw our giveaway a couple weeks ago, you saw this beautiful cable that's made with Summer Spirit LLX, has the flexibility and durability you need, as well as the distinction of being the lowest capacitance cable on the market, keeping your signal clear at an amazing 15.8 picofarad per feet. It's perfect for work in the studio or on the stage, and combined with the colors that they're known for, you'll have a cable that will stand out from everything else. So be sure to check out Caulfield Cables. Their info is in the show notes for their website and their Instagram page. And give them a shout, send them some Make More Music family love, tell them that Chris sent you. All right, on with the show. Hey, music makers, welcome back to Make More Music, the podcast that connects you to music and one another. My name is Chris. I'm a board-certified music therapist. And as always, if you're new here, I interview all kinds of music-related field professionals to show you how people make a life, a living, and build a career on their passion in music-related jobs. So how's it hanging in there, everybody? I am back to work as I record this. This is one day in. It's interesting, masks everywhere, figuring out how I'm going to operate with maybe having a shower curtain between me and clients. I don't know. It's going to be interesting. Still doing a lot of the telehealth stuff right now, but figuring it out as we go. You know, that's the story of COVID-19, figuring it out as we go, just trying to stay safe. So other than that, other news, we finished Avengers Endgame, so I have caught up to where we are now watching the new Spider-Man movie, and I will be done. So they were great. I won't give any spoilers for those other like five people that hadn't seen them like me, but they got better as they went along. I liked them a lot, and still not a huge Captain America fan, but it is what it is. Nobody's wrote in with any violent reaction, so that's cool. But today I've got a cool chat for you with an awesome, interesting guy. He's a podcast host, he is a college professor, he has history in the hospitality industry, and he is a DJ. DJ Amro, or Amani Roberts, is the author of the new book, DJs Mean Business. We connected, I was able to read his book, get kind of a peek into what it's like to be a DJ. So this is a great interview where I get to ask a lot of dumb questions about, so how did the vinyl thing work? And he's super inspiring. He talks a lot about, you know, going at it, getting after your dreams, tells you how you become a DJ. And he went to this cool like DJ Academy. And we just kind of talk about everything as far as the, you know, the side hustle and the gig economy and why it's a great time to be a creative. So I think you're going to enjoy this chat. All of his stuff is in the show notes. You should go check out his book, DJs Mean Business. And him and I are already setting up a time where I'll be chatting with him on his show, The Amani Experience. So without further ado, here is Amani Roberts of The Amani Experience and author of DJs Mean Business on Make More Music. Cool deal. Well, let's go ahead and get this ball rolling. Amani Roberts, thanks for joining me. DJ Amro, you got your new book that came out in the middle of a pandemic. I'm glad you're here, man. How's your night going?
My night's going well. Thank you very much for having me, Chris, and thanks for reading the book too. I appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to digging in. Like I said before we hit the red button, obviously, I and a lot of people know what DJs do to an extent, but I even think the book, the parallels that you draw are really cool, but I'm excited even just for the basic education of like the, you know, the evolution of DJing and where it started, because you even get into that a little bit in the book. But before we get into all of that, you ready to do some rapid fire?
I am ready. Let's go.
All right. Whatever your media player, Apple Music, Spotify, whatever, what is the last track you played? And you can elaborate on it if you want to.
Last track I played was probably Kehlani, Honey. I love that song. I remixed that song, and I just kind of put it on every so often. So that would, and that'd be on Spotify. So that would be the last track I played.
Sweet. And where can we find your remixes and stuff like that?
If you go to my YouTube, so it's Amani Roberts, and that's my YouTube channel, and we have about, let me think here, a good 45 or 50 remixes we've done. We released three different remix EPs. They're called A Starter Jacket Remix, Volume 1, 2, and 3, and those are our remixes that we've done, and I have a zip drive. I can send people Dropbox links, so that's where you can find it. YouTube's the best place to listen, though.
Sweet. That's, I love the starter jacket too. I love the throwback.
It's an ode to the 90s.
That's fun. That's my childhood. The swishy.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. That's
that reminds me of playing outside and being a kid. All right. So next up, you can take this as plainly or as philosophically as you want to take it. But if you were an instrument, what would you be?
I think I'd be a piano because that's so important to so many levels of music, and it just can, it's just awesome for many things. I won't expand too much. I could talk about pianos all day, but I'd say a piano.
I like it. Well, we're still, I thought we would be out of the weeds if you would have asked me this in March, but we're still kind of in the middle of all this craziness, and I want to know what's been inspiring you recently in the middle of all the pandemic stuff.
I would say, as we spoke about earlier, before we started hitting record, seeing all the DJs go onto Twitch and live streaming and watching their sets and seeing how creative they are, the different types of music they play, the songs they weave together, that's probably been the most inspiring thing for me during this whole pandemic.
Yeah, if you were going to point out, obviously you are doing a little bit of that too, right?
Yes, exactly.
Who are some other people you would point out and you say, I like what they're doing?
I have a person that I met that's become, you know, a good friend. I know DJ LV out of Atlanta. He's doing great stuff. A close friend, DJ Ivy and DJ Morse Code in LA are doing well. I found and discovered a DJ, DJ Archie out of Chicago, who's doing some awesome things. Those are the first three that come to mind. Yeah, those are three that I really love.
Sweet. All right. Next, the secret herbs and spices. It can be anything. You already talk about your background with business. It could be something about DJing. It could be something about life in general. What's a pro tip or a hack that you practice that you feel like other people should know about?
I would say morning pages, which is you wake up in the morning and before you, hopefully, if there are no emergencies going on in your life, check your phone. You just spend time writing, unloading your mind from the night before. Try to do this 6 or 7 days a week, usually 5 or 6 days. I think that's a element that's the secret to my success.
So what are you dumping out in that morning session?
What I'll do is I'll just write down anything that's in my mind, specifically any ideas I might have thought about during when I was sleeping, things I went through the day before, things I'm looking to do the next day, how I'm feeling about life personally and professionally. I try to also add in some like affirmations like I am healthy, I am anxiety free, things like that. I learned this from reading The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. It's one of her primary practices, which really helps creatives unlock their creativity even further, get out of ruts and burnouts. And as I'm sure you can relate to, when we have been in this pandemic for, you know, almost 5 months locked down to some effect, it's been very helpful. Now, it's also been very hard to do it some days, but I definitely try to get back to it and do it as much as possible.
Yeah. I'd say that other key of just being the first thing that you do just sets your day up. It's, you know, that whole mindset of, you know, make the bed. You know,
that
get the good start. So I like that. I like that. What was the name of that book again?
It's The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron. I highly recommend it. It's probably been the book I've given away the most in terms of gifts. You take 12 chapters. So you do a chapter a week. She gives you activities to do during the week. It helps, you know, to unlock your creativity. A lot of times us creative types have been told that creativity is not really good. And, you know, the starving artist myth. And so she helps you to get through that. Any blocks you might have experienced in your childhood or young adulthood helps you work through that. And it's two main things, the morning pages. And then each week she recommends you do an artist date, which means you go, and do something by yourself, whether it be go to a museum, go for a long walk, go and explore maybe a new store, something to do by yourself, which will help kind of hit the reset button and allow you to creatively flourish by exposing you to just new and different things. So that's kind of the foundation of it.
I love that. And that's one of the taglines of this show. It's dispelling the myth that it's all rock star and starving artists. So it's just showing, like, I think so many people still think that that dichotomy exists, but
yeah,
there are so many people living regular lives, doing creative things and living out their passion. So to kind of 180 from that topic, to go from what you do to be healthy, what is your go-to junk food?
I think we can consider pancakes junk food. I love pancakes.
That works.
But they are not good for you. So I have to, maybe once a month I can have them.
So on your pancakes, what are you doing? Are you like classic, like just butter and syrup? Or what do you go with? What do you have to pair it with?
I'm classic. Just give me some nice syrup and butter, warm pancakes. They can be as large as they can be. And I'll be in heaven.
I love that. But pancakes, not waffles.
No, pancakes the first choice, then waffles, then French toast. But, you know, 9 out of 10 times I'm going to choose pancakes over them all.
There you go. I like that. I think my choice... Man, Waffle House is what got me fat in high school. And I had to like work a long time to get that Waffle House out of here because it was conveniently right beside my high school. So, but it's still a sweet comfort, weird somewhere down in me. I love it. Yeah. Lastly, you mentioned a couple of DJs doing some cool stuff, but doesn't have to be a specific person. Is there a person, project, or organization that is doing something cool that you want to lift up with a shout out?
I want to give a shout out to Camp Spinoff. It's an overnight camp created by DJ Tina T, who's an amazing person and DJ based out of Las Vegas. She grew up in the Pacific Northwest in the Seattle area. This year would have been our 11th year. We had to cancel it, of course, but it's kids aged 13 to 17. They come from all over the world, and they come here, boys and girls, to learn about DJing, music production. We have them in camp for 6 days, 5 nights. We sleep in cabins together. It's a life-changing experience both for the campers as well as for the kids. And it's a 501(c), so it's a nonprofit. We volunteer our time. We'll have world-famous DJs coming to, you know, be there, like Spinderella, Z-Trip, tons of other popular, you know, Vice, DJ Vice based out of Vegas, just big, big DJs that come to give their time, teach the kids, and it's an amazing time. So I would love to give them a shout-out.
Yeah, that is awesome. And what has been going on with them during the pandemic? Has it just been a pause for this year's programming, or what does that look like right now?
For the most part, it's been a pause in the programming. It could be some social media activity, things like that, because we were just in the process of giving away scholarships to come to camp when we had to shut it down. So
bummer.
It's paused for now. We might think of some programming to do kind of through the summer or fall, but for right now it's paused. Just we want everyone to kind of stay safe, you know, keep creating their music. We'll share it. But for right now it's probably paused because we just, our mental headspace is not really there to plan consistent activities, but we'll get to it soon.
Yeah. It's hard to, it seems I've been kind of getting ready to gear back up as a music therapist to going back to in-person, and it seems like the finish line keeps getting pulled. Like I'm like getting ready and then I'm like, wait, no, never mind. Still Zoom for a while. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. They keep changing the goalposts, so to speak,
man. Nobody knows. And it's, you know, I think we're all just tired of it at this point. I just like, I didn't think we'd still be talking about this in August, but here we are.
Here we are.
Well, take me down your long and winding road. Before you're an author, before you're even a DJ, what were some of your first musical memories? Who are the artists that influence you? What's the culture that you grew up in that influenced you? Specific people, different things like that.
I grew up playing instruments. I think I started playing the flute when I was young and quickly switched to the saxophone, played the saxophone all the way through high school. Some of my early influences were like Tina Marie, Rick James, that whole funk era, nice. George Duke, you know, George Benson, kind of those artists as well. And then I started to fall in love with hip hop, whether it be UTFO, Houdini, Eric B and Rakim, LL Cool J, Kool Moe Dee. Those are some of my inspirations as a kid. And then it just continued to grow. I started collecting CDs at a very young age. You know, I had tapes or whatever. And then just kind of grew from there. And then, you know, continuing through college and after college, just kind of as the music scene and the music kind of grew through the golden age of hip hop and R&B and just continued to go through there, SWV, so many groups I love, Notorious B.I.G., Tupac. I mean, we could talk about this, you know, for a whole hour, but that's kind of how I got my start. And those are some of the people I grew up on. And that kind of brought me to how I look at music today and the music I love to play as well.
Well, a couple of things I always like to hit on in the way there. Did you do like formal band or marching band? What was that kind of music education like?
Yeah, I was in the jazz band all through high school. So we gigged around the world. We had a really good jazz band. Wow. If you Google Ari Ambrose, who's like a pretty popular tenor saxophone player, you know, I was his second. So he was one, I was two. Wow. And so we gigged lots of places and did lots of shows, Kennedy Center in DC, down in New Orleans. So that's what I did all through high school. And then I kind of fell off my instrumentation after high school, going to college. And then recently, or 4.5 years ago, I kind of started from scratch and learned how to play the piano, which keeps me pretty busy. And that helps me with the music production that I do as well. So I grew up in the jazz band space and then grew from there.
Man, that is great. That is great. So at what point, you talk in your book a lot about, you know, you're going into the hospitality industry and you work your way up the ladder, you're moving around to different places and you've been fascinated by DJs for a long time. So at what point do you think you first got bit by the DJ bug? And, you know, what are some of the shows and people you were seeing? Cause you even admit like you knew you wanted to do it a long time before you even took the dive in. So, yeah. Take me back to like the sensory experiences of those first couple of times that you were like, that is so cool.
I think this is probably the main story that I open up the book with when I was watching Biz Markie, who was in DC at this club called Quigley's. And he was the only DJ there playing for like 4 or 5 hours. And I was there and he went and did his typical set playing lots of hip hop, R&B, classics. In like the middle of it, he put in a whole bunch of TV theme show songs. So if you think back to that era, this is like the mid-90s, you know, we had TV shows from our childhood, Golden Girls, Facts of Life, Cosby Show, Different World, Cheers, L.A. Law, Miami Vice. All these 80s and 90s TV shows where the theme songs were so popular, he would drop them in theme song after theme song after theme song, and the crowd knew them. So we were singing along to them, you know, in a crowded club, people just sing along to all the lyrics because we knew them. And to see the effect that he had on the crowd in that club by playing these TV theme show songs was amazing. And so it was at that time period that I said, I want to do what he did. And when I was in school, I had the incorrect assumption that DJing was not a full-time job. Like that was not something you could do for a living. I was wrong. And so I continued with Marriott, moved around the country. Only when I got to LA and met some people and went to a DJ school was I able to see, no, I was wrong. This is quite legitimate. You just have to be creative with it and you should go for it. So that kind of tells you the first DJ I saw. Another one that I really saw a lot of was when I was living in Chicago. It was DJ Twilight Tone, who was Kanye West's DJ. He was amazing. I remember seeing him at the House of Blues Chicago consistently every month or so. And those are the two DJs that I saw that really stood out. Now, before I was even in college, there was a DJ by the name of DJ Curtis Cross, who's a mentor and a high school classmate of mine. He was the first one I saw, and I liked what he did too. And then once I saw Biz Markie, it kind of resurfaced that desire in my mind, in my soul. And that's when I decided that's what I wanted to do. But it took me a good 13 years to get the courage to go for it. And that's taking me to where I am now.
Yeah, now you're like spreading the gospel of DJing around. I love it. So tell me a little bit about, you know, you said working through that assumption that like, oh, I think not just DJs, that's just a lot of musicians. And, you know, we get told that a lot is, oh, that's not a job. Or I don't know how many times I was nudged to like to try and go to medical school. I was like, yeah. Who do you think I am? I'm not going to do well in medical school. Like that's not me at all. But we hear these things and we hear these starving artist rumors and all of this stuff. So what kind of started to shake your foundations in LA about that. You said it's the Scratch Academy, right?
Yeah, I went to Scratch Academy. I think for me personally, living in the West Coast, specifically Southern California, where creativity is much more encouraged. Of course, we have Hollywood here. We have Disney that's here. It's just more in the fiber of the city and the region of the country. I'll also include Northern California because they have startups and tech, and that's a very creative space as well. And I just think that being here, something about it just really inspired me to want to go for it. And I think that if you combine that with the fact that I was not happy with my work, I love being with people, I love working with people, and my job had evolved, my career with Mary had evolved to less of working with people and more about spreadsheets and meetings. So I was definitely not pleased.
Burnout.
And I was like, there's got to be more to life. You know, maybe 3 years prior to moving to Los Angeles, I lost my dad to a heart attack very suddenly. So that was kind of a reminder that, you know, tomorrow's not really guaranteed. If you're thinking about trying something, it's better to have tried it and failed than have not tried it at all. And so I think you combine all those occurrences in my life, it was just perfect timing, like a perfect storm. And I said, you know, a friend of mine introduced me to Scratch Academy. I went to one class and signed up for the entire curriculum, which is about a year long, like going to DJ college. And I said, let's see what we can do. And this was right after the time where I had left, retired from my corporate job. So I was doing a lot of freelance work, writing and things. So it was going to be a little tight, but I was still committed because I said, there's got to be more to life than this. I know that's very cliche, but I felt it. And I was like, I'm going to see what this is about because I don't want to have any regrets.
So to me, I have no conception, but I feel like a lot of people have no conception of what even just traditional music school is like. So tell me about the Scratch Academy. What is it? Because you even mentioned you had semesters and you had classes with coursework and you did active demonstrations and things like that. But walk me through kind of the path and the coursework. If you were an admissions counselor, what would you tell me about going through the Scratch Academy?
I would tell you first, it's about a year long program. They have six different classes. At the end of each class, you have to pass like an exam to graduate to the next level of the class. And some of the exams are pretty simple. Like they help you pass it. But then there's one at the end that's extremely difficult. You start off with a basic class learning with vinyl and turntables, how to drop on the one, how to count out different beats, how to mix between one song to the next song. When I say count on the one or drop on the one, that means that there's always, if you're a musician, so you know, there's always like a start of a song, like a one, two, three, four, one, two, three, four. So they teach you how to listen for that in songs and then how to drop the song. When I say drop, that means like you scratch, 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 and you drop the next song in so that you drop it on the one when the song that's already playing hits the one. That's the first, you know, step to kind of figuring out how you want to beat match. They teach you beat matching, which is like, how do you blend two songs together so that you can transition from one song to the next song? People can't really tell what you're doing. And then all of a sudden the next song is playing and you're off and running. That's one of the most important skills. They teach you that. Then you graduate on to number two, class number two, 202, more mixing skills, how to put together a 4 or 5 song set. You do that. And then you're practicing beat matching, learning a couple baby scratches. Then you have troubleshooting 303, which I talk about in the book, because troubleshooting by far is something that happens so much to DJs. And a matter of fact, like, this class has been particularly beneficial during the lockdown when we have to live stream and tech check and everything. It's every DJ, I don't care if you're world famous, has had tech issues. And if you know how to follow the signal flow and troubleshoot it, you will be able to recover very quickly. Some DJs are used to having tech people work for them. Well, maybe there's not a tech person in the middle of a pandemic that can help you. So, you know, it's just interesting. So that's one class that's been supremely valuable throughout my career. You finish that one, you move on to an elective. It's a scratching elective. They teach you different scratches and things and how to kind of use that. The turntablism, just a sneak peek, because turntablism is a whole nother part of DJing that is extremely complicated and difficult. Then you go to 404. And so this is when you get like to the meat of it. I'd say this is like, you know, medical school trying to pass your board exams.
Yeah, so you're in the upper level at this point.
Yeah. So now you're playing different sets. You're practicing and you're trying to continue and perform flawlessly different sets. When I say different sets, you could be prime time at a club. You're the headliner. You have to play hit after hit after hit. You could be opening up for a popular DJ at a club. You could be playing in a lounge, like a hotel lounge or at a restaurant or something casual. You have to be able to handle requests. So they teach you those kind of different four DJ sets, which are pretty popular and common across the world. And then that's like your pre-graduation. So then once you pass this one, you have to do a special activity, a special project at the end, whether it be like you and some of your peers have to DJ a wedding, a premiere, something like that. So once you pass that, then it's on to the final class, which is 505. And this one, you have to play five different sets. And the unique thing is that every time you play and every time you DJ, it's no guarantee that you're going to perform well. Like once you do it, you could have a good day 1 week. The next week, you could be off. You could mess up when you're mixing. You could pick the wrong songs. And the way they have the 505 class is that when you play like the opening or the primetime sets, if someone in front of you, say there's a class is like, let's say 20 DJs, they'll split you up into groups of five or six. And so you go in order. If I'm DJ number four, and DJs number one, two, and three have played a bunch of Beyonce songs, and they've played a bunch of Justin Bieber songs, and they played a bunch of maybe YG or, you know, some popular artists from now, trying to think like just popular artists from now, you can't play those same songs. So you have to really
off
have
limits.
Yeah, they're off limits, like the burn rule. So you have to go through there and then you get judged. You get judged on how your presentation is, where it's how you look, how your facial emotions are when you're DJing. You get judged on your programming, which is how well and how much of a selector you are in terms of music and putting it together. And then you get judged on your mixing skills. So once you go through that five times, you have a lounge set, an opening set, a primetime set. You have an opening set with with requests. Each set is worth, let me think here. It's like 100 points.
That's intense.
And then you have the final exam. So then the final exam, what happens is that we come to class. Usually, you know, the classes are some days during the week, but you'll come on like a Sunday morning, so to speak. We arrive there at Sunday morning at 9. You really have to make believe it's 9 p.m. So who's going to play first? You're going to have to open up. Just like you're opening up, the same rules are in effect. You have four judges that are there judging your set. And then you go through that the whole day. There could be 15 or 20 DJs that are trying to pass the final. You go through that, and then you're judged. And I think I calculate the points wrong, but in order to pass the class, you have to have 320 out of 400 total points. And so for me, my first time I went through the final class, I ended up with 319.
Ugh.
I think, or 318, I think. 319
that part or 318. Part of the book is gut-wrenching.
Yes, I was 2 points away. Yeah, exactly. I was stressed too, let me tell you. So yeah. I was 2 points away from passing, and you have to take the final class over again. And that was probably one of the landmark moments of my career, because that was when I had to say, do I really want to do this or do I want to take my ball and go home? And I decided to stay. And like I explained before, there's no guarantee that you'll pass the next class. There have been countless people that have taken 505 three, four, five times and have never passed because it's difficult and people don't maybe get better or they just are stubborn. So I had to really swallow my pride. One of my previous instructors, V-Fresh, he tutored me because I had to kind of rebuild my foundation. It ends up that now he and I collaborate and we make up a Starter Jacket remix. So he's my production partner and my piano instructor. So he helped me to build my foundations up. I retook the class again and the final, ended up getting one of the highest scores ever. And so that kind of part of the story had a happy ending. But that takes you through scratch. I hope I explained it well and didn't leave
anything.
That's
awesome.
But that's kind of what it's all about. It's an amazing community. It's kind of changed now. It's a little different. But for when I was there, it was an amazing community. I met some really close friends that I still are close with, like DJ Flossie. She's a dentist by day and a DJ at nighttime. She's close. We support each other on our streams and stream back and forth now. V-Fresh, as I said, just countless people there that have really helped to kind of grow my friendship base as well.
I love that. And I find it super interesting just thinking about, I would imagine the average kid nowadays would not understand. And I mean, vinyl is making a resurgence, but just understanding the history of that. So what does a rig look like that's different between running a vinyl set or running something on, you know, a MacBook that's out now. What's the difference in different ways that people would approach it with rigs and things like that?
So there's probably two or three popular rigs. What I prefer to use, and what you'll see me using when I'm live streaming, is we can still use two turntables, vinyl, and a mixer in the middle. I use like Pioneer S9, and we have what's called control records. So through the Pioneer S9, we're able to plug that mixer into our computer, and what it does is it uses the mixer as an intermediary. So I have MP3s on my computer. Through the software, I can drag, you know, songs to the left turntable or the right turntable. It functions as a record. So like if I have the song queued up, I can scratch. You'll hear it scratch. I can, you know, hit it and it'll go faster, slower. So we go back and forth, left and right, using that mixer and the control vinyl, which is just like adjusted vinyl, which means that instead of having a record that's playing on the vinyl, it's really the MP3 that you drag on. So it just keeps going around in a circle. And we use that to go back and forth. Now, say you brought in a record, Chris. I'm like, oh, I want you to play this record while we're going, and you have the actual record. I could mix that in as well because it can go back and forth between the computer and the vinyl. So that's kind of the typical rig right there. Mixer, two turntables, go back and forth. You'll also see people with CDJs, which if you remember CDs, instead of the turntables, they'll have a right deck and a left deck that are shaped like CDs and a CDJ. So it's the same thing. No vinyl. That's one. You have the mixer in the middle. You go from there, or it's built all in. And the third step is like a controller. A controller is like a smaller, more compact device. Has a still same concept, a left deck and a right deck. The mixer is built in. It's much more portable, and it's a really good way, entry-level way for people to kind of learn how to DJ and do that. So those are probably the three most common rig setups in terms of mixer, turntable. You have your computer, microphone, and then you go from there.
Well, I feel like I've played a fair share of random gigs just being, you know, the college student and the guitar player. You know, I have a wedding coming up next month that I don't know how it's going to work. I'll be wearing a mask and stuff, but I'm sure you have some interesting performance stories. So where's some of the weirdest places you've played and some of the coolest places you've played, different things like that?
Weird places, maybe like, you know, in a museum behind a couple woolly mammoth displays or whatever.
That counts.
That'd be pretty wild. One of the coolest places I played was at the Peterson Automotive Museum here in LA. So I was playing between like these cars that were worth $200,000 or $300,000. That's pretty cool as well, on the rooftop of some places in the LA Coliseum, up on like the VIP deck. I've DJed there. I DJed in Vegas in front of 15 or 20,000 people in the middle of a bike race. When people were racing around the track, I was in the middle. Those are some cool spots. One of my favorites is in Cuiabá, Brazil for the 2014 World Cup. So I DJed down there for like a private event at a hotel. That was cool. Those are probably my top four or five right there.
That's pretty awesome. So, you get this idea somewhere along the lines. When does the idea first start to germinate for you about this book and kind of marrying your hospitality background with this interesting story that takes you through literally one night of a DJ? So we don't even need to talk about the timeline. If people want to know what a night as a DJ is like, they need to go buy your book. Where did that idea start to come from? And I kind of want to also go in with the idea of, as writing a book is another kind of creative endeavor that I think even a musician who has tackled some of your fears, like you said, like, I went to the Scratch Academy, I'm doing it now. Then there's this whole other thing. It's like, now writing, that's a whole other block. So what made you decide to take on that giant as well?
Yes. And what a giant it is. I really want to show to people that DJs are not just button pushers that jump around and, you know, push buttons and just play music. I want people to understand that we are very complex individuals. We are sophisticated business people, and we are extremely talented, whether we're quadruple tasking at one time. So, for example, you could be playing one song, mixing from one song to the next. You're on the microphone talking. You also have to be very emotionally intelligent. You have to be able to read the crowd. Are they feeling the song you're playing? Yes, keep going in that same direction. If not, you have to switch it up. Also, you have to make sure, is your client happy, whether it be the club owner, the bar owner, are they happy? Is the bride and groom, are they happy? Is the mother of the bride and groom happy? You have to really kind of juggle between that, managing people. But then also you have to be three or four songs ahead. Like, this is where we're going. How do we get there? So you're playing chess with the music. And I want people to understand that and really, you know, respect DJs for what they are and more, because we're complex creatures. I hate to say creatures, but that's what we are. We're complex individuals. And that was reason number one. Second is I wanted to push my DJ career and my creative career even further. I didn't want to just kind of stop and continue to work and try to DJ the biggest parties at the biggest events. That's always a goal. But I wanted to do more. So I figured writing a book would be great, because it would allow me to grow my brand so I could then get more speaking opportunities. It would add to the credibility of my own personal brand. And, you know, I like to write. So I said, well, let me try this out. And this can be a way for me to get additional gigs. So that was kind of the thought process there. And let me think, what else? Those are the three main reasons in terms of why. Okay. Now, well, I can continue to talk about kind of how I got through the blocks, because there were some blocks there.
Yeah, let's go into that. I can imagine going through publishing nowadays is, you know, harder than ever, you know, traditional publishing. And I would say with that, and also you said this book came out in April during the middle of a pandemic. So tell me a little bit about the general challenges of, you know, publishing and managing all of those new relationships and getting turned down, I'm assuming. I don't think I've ever heard anyone who just everything always gets published. So I published one academic paper and I was like, yeah, that's probably enough for me. I thought I wanted to do a PhD, and I was like, you know, master's is probably good. I think I'll stop. Yeah. So go ahead.
I think that the first block that I had to get through before even starting writing was just working through imposter syndrome. In my mind, I was like, who am I to be a DJ and write a book when I'm definitely not one of the best DJs in the world? I'm also comparing myself to other DJs who had 20, 25 years of experience. I'm not the most experienced DJ in the world, you know? And so that was a big issue, because I was scared of what people would think, like, who is Imani to write this book? You know, he's just, you know, well, I'm not an average DJ, but he's just an average DJ is what they might say. And so I really had the fortunate ability and people around me to encourage me to, you know, it's okay. It's not that, you know, who else has worked for a major internationally known brand, hotel brand, who has then left that to go on to DJ, been through what you've been through with the skills you have that can tell your story your way. And that was really the best advice and lesson I learned, that there's no one else who can tell your story but you, because you have lived it your way. So that helped me kind of get through the imposter syndrome a little bit, to at least put the pen to paper. Then you start writing. I believe I spoke about Camp Spinoff before, but I went to a podcast conference, Podcast Move It. We were in Philly, and I sat in on a breakout where they were talking about how a book can really elevate your brand and lead to all these opportunities. And it was at that moment that it clicked, like, yes, that's the next step I want to do. Because I had a coach that said, you know, if you want to do something to kind of really elevate your brand, you can start a podcast, you can write a book, you can video blog, you can do a couple other things. I had already had the podcast going. I said, you know what? The book is the next step, and I can probably do an interesting twist on my story. Then you start to write. That was August. I went to Camp Spinoff as a counselor. We were in August. I was wake up early. I started writing. That's August. I've probably finished writing March. That's 7 months. I will say that there was a lot of procrastination, which is some of the blocks you have to get through, because you just, it's hard. Once you get through the story, you got to write and you got to add some meat to it. And it's very hard. It's difficult. You push it off because you still have to work at the same time. Luckily for me, the company I was working with to help me publish everything, Book Launchers, they gave me a really great writing coach, Tim. Shout out to Tim. He really worked with me, stayed on top of me, and we got through the first draft. Then they send it to the editor, and I would say that this is probably one of the more humbling experiences. The editor gets your book, and then she just came back with so many edits. It took me from when when I got the edits back in May, which was close to the end of the semester I was teaching, I didn't finish the edits until 4th of July. And so, because I just put it down, because I was so, my ego took a blow and I was so hurt. but all of her suggestions were perfect, were right on time. One of the best two suggestions she gave me was, one, when you write, tell a lot of stories. And when you tell the stories, you have to use as many of your five senses as possible, whether it be sight, smell, touch, hearing. I forget the fifth one. But all the five senses when you're telling a story, because then people, if they're an auditory learner, they'll know from hearing. Maybe if they're visual, you know, they'll look at the visuals that you're describing and picture what you're going through there. But she says that's going to help your story resonate with so many more people. So do that with every story you tell in the book, which I try to do, which is great advice. And then I had a lot of songs that were in the book initially. She said you should probably take out a lot of the songs, because 5 years from now, there might be one song out of the 30 that you mentioned that would still be considered a classic. And you don't want to date yourself or the book by putting in a lot of these songs. Mm. So you can take the songs out and just kind of work around them. And that will help your book have a longer life.
Be vague about those kind of things.
Yeah, like just say a genre instead of a specific song. And so great advice, great, great advice. So I did that, got the edits back in May. And by the time we had the proofreading, two proofreads go through, we were pretty much done in like, say, October, November. And then we created the cover and I shot the cover. That's me on the cover. We shot the cover and that was great in December. So we were done by like January with the release date of April 14th. And we know that we all got locked down October, or pretty much March 13th, the first weekend or second weekend of March. So I was looking at a book coming out. I had all these events planned, a launch, a party with a DJ cake, going to different cities, speaking at different conferences to really launch the book. I was set up. I was impressed. And all that went away. So what I did do is embrace the whole live streaming trend early on and said, you know, I'm going to try to live stream a book release party. So I did that. I'm a professor at Cal State University Fullerton. I had two of my students from Cal State University Fullerton sing during the book launch. I had my other close friend that's based here where I live in like South Bay of Los Angeles, V. Torres. She sang as well, one of my favorite songs that she does. We had that. I DJed a little bit in the live stream Q&A. I did two different book readings, two different Q&As. And it just went really well. Looking back, awesome. That was like 4 months ago. So I know so much more now, but it went so well then. I was very, very fortunate. So that kind of takes you through the writing process from start to finish. I left out a bunch, of course. And then the launch that got us to like April.
Whew. So out of all that, you've had a couple of months to digest the responses you're getting and what you've seen. What have you learned after this initial launch and kind of keeping the flame kindled and stuff like that?
Really follow up and encourage friends and family when they buy the book to go onto Amazon and leave reviews. That's very important. I'm still working through that. And then just continue to do outreach to speak about the book and spread the word, because it's a marathon. You know, I'm not going to be a writer that's maybe, you know, like a Neil Gaiman who releases a book on Thursday and by Monday it's already, you know, a best-selling book on Amazon. That's not going to happen for me yet. So just really, you know, don't view that too negatively and just keep working, spreading the word, talking about the book, sharing the story, and momentum will start to build. And, you know, I have to keep it on perspective. Like, I had lots of really industry-related events that were set up for me to speak at, give workshops, talk about the book. So understand that those things went away temporarily. So instead of maybe having a, you know, a really big boom at the end of 6 or 9 months, it could be at the end of 18 or 24 months, where once we get back to meeting again in person, that's when I could see the boom. So keep active in the interim. Use the book to kind of, because I'm going to write a second book, so use that book to kind of be a launch for the second book and just keep moving forward.
Well, I would say a slow burn and something that lasts is always something worth chasing.
I would agree 100%.
So you're also a professor. You also have this podcast. Tell me a little bit about your podcast and some of the other things. You do all kinds of stuff. So tell me a little bit about your podcast, because you talk to a lot of creatives on there as well.
Yes. It's called the Imani Experience Podcast. You can find it on all the platforms, Spotify, Apple Music, et cetera, iHeartRadio, YouTube. I interview people who used to work in the corporate space and have left that to do something more creative. So it could be, you know, a yoga instructor that used to work in retail. It could be, you know, someone who used to be a lawyer that has left to start their own Pilates studio or be a dog walker, or the most recent person I interviewed used to work for Timberland and then she left and created her own facilitation company. It's just a wide variety of people. We talk for a good 45, 50 minutes. They share lessons they've learned, things they would tell their younger self, turning points in their life. And so that's what the podcast is about. We just last week celebrated the beginning of season 4. So that means we're up to 151 episodes.
Congrats. And
yeah, that's what the podcast is about. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, that is quite a haul. That's a lot of episodes.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, I feel you. I understand at least somewhat. Yeah. Well, with all the different things you do and how driven you are and how you've kind of reached out, and even through your podcast, you're still encouraging people to go for it. You know, you had this wake up call with your dad, unfortunately, and different things like that. So what would you say to those people? Maybe it's someone who's feeling stuck in corporate America. Maybe it's, you know, the teenager that's wondering if they should go to music school or if they should do whatever it is. What would you say to those people?
I think for the person who maybe is already in corporate America and is, you know, not fulfilled or kind of heading towards burnout, I would say definitely try to pursue something more creative. You might have to do it on the side. I started DJing on the side while still working. But definitely dedicate some time to, you know, if there is something that you had in you since you were young, or even if you were older that you really want to try and you really want to pursue, I believe you have to go for it. You have to find a way to try to go for it, whether it could be dedicating some time on the weekend or at night to figure out what that is and pursue it, even if it's taking one step at a time. Because as we know, things change so fast in life. We've just lived through, you know, a massive change for the entire world. And, you know, tomorrow's not guaranteed. Very cliche, but very true. So go for it. Like, try something out. Test it out. It might not work for you. But then again, it could work. And you don't want to have any regrets in saying, you know, what if? So try to figure out what it is. Surround yourself with people who are going to support you. Also be honest and tell you what you might need to hear when you don't want to hear it. But I think that, you know, you have to go for it. You have to try it out because you never know what can happen. It can lead you to something else. It can lead you to different directions. For the younger humans, people that are listening, that, you know, think about going to music school and all that, I definitely am a proponent of that. I think that if you have it in you at a young age to go for it and be creative, I want to say that, as you have agreed with, like, the whole starving artist is a myth. You can go to music school. You can teach people how to play instruments. There's lots of different things you can do now. Drive for Uber, deliver for Instacart that can support you as you're going and pursuing your dream. The way the world is now, you're shifting to a gig economy, which is benefits all creatives, because you can have your gig economy during the first half of the day and then do your creative education or work in the evening and nighttime and afternoon. So this is perfect time for you to go for it. And you definitely don't want to wake up and be 25 or 30 and be like, oh my gosh, I should have gone to music school. Or, oh my gosh, I should have tried to start this or do this creative venture, write that book, write these songs. So that's the message. I mean, for them, like, go for it now. You know, I know we have to listen to our parents and they have our best intentions in mind, but, you know, they grew up in a different era, a different time, and things are different, and it's better. We are better positioned for creative people to flourish now than we ever have been before.
I love that, man. Well, we've had a lot of wisdom drop in here, and hold on, give me a second. I got to think of where I want to steer the ship next. One thing I've been realizing after talking with so many different people, and, you know, I originally started the show thinking I want to talk to different professionals, and, like we said, dispel that myth of starving artists. But the other thing too is, there is no shame in it being a fulfilling part of your life, especially, like you're saying, the gig economy, like the starving artist. It doesn't have to be you're the next Kanye West, right? Like, and maybe your ego has to get checked a little bit that you're not going to be that, but you can make a living, or it can be a side hustle, or it can be a fulfilling part of your life that doesn't even have to be the driving factor. So how do you help people or mentor people when they're trying to figure out where does this fit into their life? Have you had to deal with that at all?
Definitely. I think just kind of looking at the different income streams that they currently have, reevaluating what skills you have, because if you are a good writer, but you want to learn how to sing and sing in a band, okay, well, you know, you can write for different publications and get paid that way, which will help support you. You can write songs and sell them and work with other people. So you get your songwriting credits. You get all sorts of sync placements. You get, you know, performance revenues. That's an example I love to use. Like, you know, maybe if you're not the best singer, but you can write phenomenal lyrics, there's a place for you. You know, also, if you want to become like a dancer, you know, but maybe you're not the best dancer, but you really understand the techniques well, well, then you can become an instructor. And that can help you fund yourself as you want to grow your dance company. I think that there's just so many things that you can do. And I try to share different stories from different people who have left and have done something creative and show how they started. I think reading autobiographies is a really great place to kind of learn so that you can, you know, listen to people's stories. I think also different interviews are out there where you can learn a lot from listening to how people started. One of my favorite interviews, I think it was Kevin Hart, and you know, he would work and he would go do gigs at nighttime for like 7-10 years until he blew up. And so if you have it in you and you want to go for it, find different ways to earn revenue that can allow you the time and the space, both space in the physical world and then mentally, to really work on your creative craft. Because what you will find is that as you're being fulfilled with your creative life, your professional, whatever you're choosing to do professionally, will get better as well. And I think that's very important. So I try to help people recognize different careers or jobs that would fit well for me. I've been very fortunate to discover and become a professor. Being a professor, you have a pretty... not very flexible, but your schedule is not really structured like you got to go to work every day 9 to 5. Like you have class and then you have office hours and then you're grading papers on your own. That fits very, very well with being a DJ and a music producer. So it works well. I discovered this later on, 2.5 years ago, but it fits well now. So just what can you do to find different opportunities for you to make money, but also give you enough space and time to be creative? And I think that once people see the options out there, they're like, oh, I didn't realize I could do this. You know, I can put 2 part-time jobs together that will give me benefits and I can still be creative also. So it's just really sharing different stories through interviews, autobiographies, podcast episodes, and saying, check out what this person did. Maybe you'd fit in with them, or check out what they did. Let me know what you think.
Yeah, there's literally a treasure trove of free things, like things that don't cost you a dime.
Right.
Alas, here we are, and you know, people still got to figure out their own path. And you know, if they are, like you said, 25-30, I've met people at retirement age going back to music therapy school. So I just want to kind of to wrap up and get towards the end here. I want to hear your philosophy on why you think it matters and why you inspire other people to make more music and be creative.
I think it matters because we have to be courageous. Courage is one of the most underrated virtues in the world. And I think that if you're courageous, you're going to get through fear. Fear is something that stops so many people from pursuing what they really want to do. They're scared of being broke. They're scared of what their parents will think, what their friends will think. They're scared that they will fail. And I just really want to encourage people to understand that for it to matter, you just need to be courageous, like go for it, like feel the fear, as they say, and do it anyways, because it really is heartbreaking when you see people who are supremely talented, but have the fear of going for it because they just are so worried about money and what people will think. I understand money concerns, but don't let that trip you up from following your passions. Be creative, find a way to go for it. And I just really like to encourage people about that and for them to be courageous, because they'll find out that, first of all, when you get through fear, you'll find out that there's nothing on the other side. It's nothing. And just go for it, be courageous, and you'll be able to determine what matters to you and how you want to pursue it. So that's kind of how I'll answer that question.
Well, Imani, I feel like if people don't feel fired up after this chat, they need defibrillators or something. You know, we gotta check for a pulse. So, where do you want people to find? Obviously, your book is available. DJ's Mean Business is available everywhere. But where do you want to point people to find more about you, your podcast, the different things you're doing?
If you go to my website, AmaniExperienceOneWord.com, that's a great place. My first name is A, M as in Mary, A, N as in Nancy, I. That's a great place. All the socials are at Amani Experience. Particularly if you're curious about what DJs are doing now during the pandemic, go to twitch.tv/AmaniExperience. You'll see me live streaming 2 or 3 days a week. And that's something cool that I love to encourage people to watch and see and stop in the chat, leave a question, a comment. As you said, the book is everywhere. You can get a signed copy of the book if you go to my website and order it there. Yeah, those are the main places to find me. If you send me a message, I'll write you back. We can start a conversation, but that's the best place to reach me. And please feel free to reach out because I love to meet new people and talk and just share stories and help. I'm here to help.
Boom. Well, this has been a great chat. Like I said, the DJ history and taking me a little bit through that, as well as just kind of, like you said, carving your own path. So thanks for your time. For Amani and for Chris, everybody, remember, give more grace, share more love, and make more music. All right. I hope you enjoyed that chat with Amani. He is a cool dude. He's inspiring. And I think you should check out his book. I think you should check out all of his stuff. It's in the show notes, the links to his website, a link to the book. If you do read it, give him a review, give him a thumbs up, go check out his show. Let's support these other people who are out there. Other than that, y'all know you can always get a hold of me on Instagram at make.more.music. Tell me what you thought about the show. You can send me a DM. If you're an artist that wants your music featured in the New Music Shoutout, hit me up. If you are a brand that wants to collaborate, hit me up. And other than that, you can send me an email as well at makemoremusicpodcast@gmail.com. But today, before we go, I have a new music shout out. Today's new music shout out comes specifically from Amani and his A Starter Jacket remixes that he talked about. So these are the original parts of his remixes that they put out so that other DJs can sample and stuff like that. So I really liked on the newest one, the A Starter Jacket Volume 3, the track Disturbance. I really like the lo-fi, the spacey synth, and I just think it's a cool groove. So enjoy this for today. This is A Starter Jacket from DJ Amro Amani himself. So enjoy it. Give more grace, share more love, make more music.